Lecture 12, Fighting Unemployment.
This macroeconomics portion of the course begins with four lectures concerning the primary four goals of macroeconomic policy. The previous lecture focused on the goal of economic growth. This lecture will focus on the goal of low unemployment, explaining what it means and why it's important. What is unemployment exactly? Well, that may seem a question which is almost too obvious to need answering, but in economics there are no questions too obvious as to not need answering. There are really two different ways of thinking about what unemployment is. One comes out of the government survey figures, which actually give the official unemployment numbers you see in the newspaper. The other comes out of economic theory. And while these two concepts of unemployment overlap, they're by no means exactly identical. The survey of unemployment is done monthly. It's a survey of about 50,000 households. It's done by folks at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. The survey has a variety of questions about economic status. It's used for many different purposes. But the two which really matter for our purposes at the moment, in terms of the unemployment numbers, are two questions. One question is, are you employed? And obviously enough, if you're employed, then they don't want to count you as unemployed. The other question is more subtle. The other question says that if you are not employed, if you're unemployed, then are you looking for work? If you are looking for work, then you're counted as officially unemployed in the statistics. But if you say, I don't have a job and I'm not looking, then they don't count you as unemployed, and you're not counted as unemployed in the official statistics. If you think about these two questions, what they really do is they partition the adult population of the United States into three different groups. It's useful to think about these three different groups to get a grip on what economists mean by unemployment. About two-thirds of the U.S. population between the ages of 20 and 64 has a job. So they have a job, they're working, there's no question that they're in the labor force and that they're certainly not unemployed. About a third of the U.S. population, however, is not looking. And those people are simply counted as out of the labor force. They don't show up in the unemployment statistics. Then there's a tiny little sliver in between those two, about 4% of the working population at this time, which is counted as people who both don't have a job and are looking for work. And those folks are the official unemployed. This sort of way of thinking about unemployment raises a variety of questions. And there are questions about whether the official unemployment figures perhaps understate or overstate the true amount of unemployment that might be out there in the economy. For example, let's think for a moment about reasons why this might understate the amount of unemployment that's out there. What if you're someone who's been out there looking for work for some time, but perhaps in the region you live in or the sort of work that you do, you just can't find a job? So you've looked and you've gotten discouraged. You've given up looking. When the government survey people call up, they say, do you have a job? You say no. They say, are you looking for a job? And you say no. You're not counted as unemployed. You're counted as being out of the labor force because of those two answers. But it would probably be more accurate to say not that you're unemployed, but that you're discouraged. You're willing to work. You were looking for work. You'd like to have a job. You just can't seem to find one, and you've gotten discouraged about looking. We can also imagine people who might be looking, and then just out of desperation or out of sheer economic need, they took a job which was perhaps much lower down on the scale than they really wanted. Perhaps it pays less, it doesn't have as many hours, it doesn't have benefits. Well, those people would all be counted as employed in the employment statistics, but they wouldn't necessarily be happy people. They might actually be employed but underemployed in the sense that they're capable of doing more or better work. So if there are a number of people who are working but underemployed and a number of people who are not even counted as unemployed but discouraged, then our unemployment statistics would understate the degree of unemployment that's out there. But let's think about it on the flip side for a moment. It's also possible, for various reasons, that our unemployment statistics might overstate the degree of unemployment. Imagine for a moment that you're sitting at home. You're sitting at home and they call you up and they say, are you looking for work? And you say no. And then they say, are you looking for work? Well, remember, this is the government calling. This is the government which is perhaps paying you welfare benefits, which may be providing Medicaid support for your kids. And when somebody from the government calls up and says, are you looking for work? There's a strong incentive to say, oh, you bet I am. You know, I'm out there at 6:30 every morning pounding the pavement looking for a job. I'm out there every day. And that may not actually be true. You may have been looking for a while. You may not be looking that intensely. You may not have looked at all for a couple of weeks. So to the extent that the existence of the government survey encourages people to say, yep, I'm out there looking, perhaps the unemployment rate is gathering up people who really should be counted as out of the labor force. They're just not looking all that hard. This line between being in the labor force and out of the labor force is really a delicate business. I mean, clearly it captures something real about people and about the human condition. There are a lot of people out there who really don't want to work. I mean, they really are not looking for jobs. And often they will be people who have some source of support. Perhaps their spouse works, and they have a perfectly good economic standard of living. They have no real intention of going out there and looking for work. And it would be wrong for economists to say, well, the goal of economic policy should be that every single adult between the age of 20 and 65 has a job. And certainly that would be a silly way to think about what the economy is there for. We want to offer people flexibility and freedom to make the choices that they think are best. But once you start saying, well, there are some people who are out of the labor force and some people who are in the labor force, and are you looking or are you not looking, you've introduced a degree of squishiness into what these unemployment figures mean, and we should acknowledge that squishiness up front and say that it's there. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does actually ask other questions, which try and estimate the number of workers who are discouraged, workers who might be thinking about jobs, and they try and estimate a whole bunch of different things other than the unemployment rate. They don't show up in the newspapers, but they at least try. However, this way of thinking about the unemployment rate, this way of thinking about squishiness in statistics, raises a broader issue, an issue which comes up throughout these lectures and which is worth sort of taking a moment on here. With any economic statistic, whether it's gross domestic product, whether it's poverty, whether it's inflation, as we'll talk about in a minute, whether it's the trade deficit, with any one of these economic statistics, we would have to say that none of them measure perfectly what you're aiming at. There's always problems. There's always difficulties. There's always these issues of, is it a little high, is it a little low? How do you look at it? How do you think about it? And we should understand those questions, we should recognize them, we should spend some time looking at them. But we don't want those existence of those questions to drive us into some sort of a world of apathy where we can't believe any statistic ever. After all, unemployment has been measured pretty much the same way for a long period of time. When it goes up, it means something. When it goes down, it means something. It may not capture every aspect of employment that's out there. There are always going to be some questions to ask, but you don't want to just throw out all of statistics because, after all, no statistic is perfect. If you spend your life looking for the perfect statistic, it's going to be a long hunt. What about on the economist model side of unemployment, this alternative way of thinking about unemployment? Well, as you should probably guess, if we're going to think about economists and unemployment, then we're going to think about, all together now, supply and demand. Supply and demand in the labor market in this case. Think about the labor market for a moment as we talked about it in the earlier lecture with regard to unemployment. What we would imagine would happen is if there's unemployment, then the quantity of labor being supplied in the economy, that is the people who want to work, is bigger than the quantity of labor being demanded in the economy, the number of people businesses want to hire. If we think about that sort of a gap in any kind of a real market, what would we expect to happen? Well, if the quantity supplied is bigger than the quantity demanded, we would expect there to be downward pressure on the price. In this case, downward pressure on the wage. We would expect wages to come down, and as wages come down, businesses would be willing to hire more people. Some people would drop out of the labor force. They would leave the labor force. And as a result, we would head toward an equilibrium where the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded of labor would be equal to each other. And in that situation, if the quantity supplied and quantity demanded are equal, then we'd have a situation where, by definition, really, there wouldn't be any unemployment. Let me think about that or pose that question to you a little bit differently. When we were thinking about the supply of labor, remember that we were saying that as the wage went higher and higher, then more and more people would be willing to supply a higher and higher quantity of labor. So imagine this situation. Imagine someone who's sitting around all day and they're saying, you know, I'd love to work. I'm unemployed, I really want to work. And you know something? I'm as good as anybody else in this economy, and that means I am worth $300,000 a year. I'm worth it, by golly, and I'm going to wait until I am offered the job where I'm worth $300,000 a year. Now, would you count that person as unemployed or just as stupid? An economist would say, sure, maybe they're willing to work at $300,000 a year, but they're being utterly unrealistic. If you're being utterly unrealistic, we shouldn't count you as unemployed. We should count you as one of those people way off there at the upper end of the supply curve who's just not interested in working for what the market is willing to pay them. We don't want to count those people as unemployed. When we think about unemployment, what we want to think about are people who are willing to work at the going wage rate and who would take a job at the going wage rate if it were offered to them, but somehow have a hard time finding work. And if you think about those particular people, what you have to think about is a situation where the quantity supplied of labor is bigger than the quantity demanded. But for some reason, the economy gets stuck there. For some reason, the wage does not come down to eliminate that gap. For some reason, the economy wages are sticky, and they say stuck above the equilibrium point. Now, that idea of wages being sticky and not diminishing in such a way as to eliminate unemployment is a tricky idea. It's actually been the subject of an enormous amount of economic theorizing over the last few decades. If the wage is above the equilibrium, then why don't we just solve unemployment by having wages come down? Why don't we just have lower wages for everyone? And if we had lower wages, then, as I said before, we'd have more companies that are willing to hire at the lower wage, people would leave the labor force, and we would get rid of unemployment. Well, the answer to that's obvious enough. Lower wages would be a bad thing. Lower wages would reduce people's standard of living. As a policy goal, saying, let's let everyone have lower wages is kind of a peculiar way of thinking about the world. It would mean less demand in the economy, and if there's less demand in the economy, there'll be less production, less people buying stuff, and the result could be that the whole economy tips down into recession. So this idea that we could solve unemployment by falling wages, while it's possible in theory, it's really not very attractive as a policy prescription. Very occasionally, you'll see a situation where there'll be one individual company, and sometimes this happens with an entrepreneurial company that's getting started. That company may be going through cash flow problems of one sort or another, and you'll hear a story, well, boy, when everyone was going through cash flow problems, everyone did something like took every other Friday off. They took a pay cut, effectively, in order to help mean that company didn't have to reduce its employment level. And in the case of one company, that can work all right. But when you start talking about the whole macro economy and somehow saying that we should divide up all the jobs, that's much less likely to work well for a number of different companies. Why is it that wages don't seem to fall? Why is it that wages are sort of sticky and stop declining? Well, there are a variety of possible reasons, many of which we've talked about in earlier lectures. One, for example, is that there are minimum wage laws out there. If there are minimum wage laws, then the wages are not going to go down below the minimum wage because by law they can't. And that will contribute to some small extent, as we talked about before, to unemployment among low-skilled workers. We could also imagine that there are union contracts. If there are union contracts, then wages can't drop because there's a contract saying what the union needs to be paid. And again, if there are union contracts and if the union is one of those unions which is forcing wages higher and higher, then that will tend to create some unemployment elsewhere in the economy. But there are also a number of interesting theories about why wages don't fall for other people. Because after all, the minimum wage affects a relatively small number of workers at the bottom of the wage distribution. And unions, as we remember, are decreasing in the number of people who belong to unions. The kinds of theories that we've come up with as economists go something like this. Imagine, for example, that you think about your company, you think, boy, I really need to cut wages, or I really need to cut expenses, because my company's not doing very well. There's a couple different ways I could do this. One way would be to try and cut wages for everybody in the company. The other way would be to lay some people off. Gotta choose one of these plans, because I just can't cover my expenses right now. Well, which one of those do you choose? Here's the problem you run into. If I say, okay, I'm going to cut wages. I know that some of my workers will quit. And I know which workers will quit. It'll be all my best workers. Because after all, the best workers are the ones who can go to some other company and get a well-paid job. The people who don't quit and stay with me are going to be the people who don't have any other options. So if I institute some kind of an across-the-board wage cut, my worry is that I'm going to lose my best workers. I may not even be certain who my best workers are. If it's a really big company, you don't always know worker by worker who's doing a great job. But boy, if I start having across-the-board cuts, those who have other options are going to take their other options. And the result will be that I'll tend to lose my good people. On the other hand, if I go through my company and I try and lay people off, well, heck, at least I can try and choose the people I think are low performers or the people who are less important to the company. And as I try and choose those people, I at least know that I can try and hang on to the people I'm certain are really important to my operation. So that idea that you might lose your workers is really an adverse selection problem. It's a problem of not having perfect information about your workers and a problem of adverse selection, as we talked about back in Lecture 10. You can also imagine that, to some extent, what happens in the workplace is what can be thought of as an implicit contract. An implicit contract works like this. I work harder than I really need to, and it's certainly true for me. I work harder than I really need to for the pay that I get. On the other side of it, my employer probably pays me a little bit more than they really need to. You can think of this as kind of an implicit contract, or as sometimes some economists sometimes put it, a gift exchange. I give the gift of working a little harder than I need to. My employer gives me the gift of paying me a little better than I need to. And when you've got that kind of a match happening, you've really got an active, healthy, useful workforce where people are happy in their jobs and stay there over a long period of time. If an employer were to show up and say, well, now I'm cutting everybody's wages, morale goes way down. They've sort of broken their side of the gift exchange. They've broken the implicit contract. And if they start cutting wages, people are going to react by saying, well, I'm not going to work extra. I'm not going to work overtime. I'm not going to hang out here at the office. And as a result of that, what you would expect to see happening is that even if you cut wages, production may drop far more, quality may drop off in ways that really imperil the success of the firm. This whole idea of why is it wages don't get cut, why is it that layoffs happen more often than wages being cut, is an area of extremely active research among economists since the 1970s and into the 1990s. But whatever the reason, the interesting problem here is that, remember, whatever the causes of wages not falling very much, we didn't really want wages to fall. It's not really a useful policy goal to say, I would like wages to fall. And so if we don't want wages to fall, then we shouldn't worry that much that they're not falling. That's not really the problem. And making wages fall isn't really going to be the solution either. So when we talk about policies to fight unemployment, we want to get away from this. We want to just accept that wages don't fall and think about what other factors we can manipulate. But before getting on to that question of what policies one might conceivably use to fight unemployment, there's a prior question we need to address. And that prior question is, why is unemployment bad? Again, this may seem a question which is just too obvious to need answering. Of course, we all know unemployment is bad, but let's try and spell out why it's bad in an economically meaningful and relevant way. First of all, it hurts individuals. It hurts the individuals who are involved. After all, the individual people who are unemployed lose not only the money they would get, but their families suffer a lot of instability. And more than that, there's a real sense of self-worth tied up in employment in our culture. A few years ago, my immediate family was in sort of an odd position, where both my father and my father-in-law, both men about 60 years old, were laid off in big corporate downsizings. These are both men who'd worked all their lives. I don't think either of them had ever been unemployed before for really any period of time. And they're both men who come from a generation when it was really a man's job to support his family, and it was recognized as a man's job by both the men and the women. So hitting age 60 and suddenly finding both of them without work, downsized, looking for other things to do, was a trauma for our family. Now, it wasn't a terrible trauma. People had savings. They could go off and do some other things. They could look for consulting work. They could balance things out in one form or another. I'm not saying that either of our families was reduced to terrible poverty or, you know, had to sell off the wedding china or something like that. But nonetheless, the stress was real and not something to be giggled at. And for a number of families, as unemployment goes on, the economic stress and the personal stress level can get higher and higher and higher. And if unemployment is something that affects people's happiness, then lower unemployment really needs to be something that economists think about seriously, not just for its economic factors, but because it really injures the people involved in some deep psychic ways. Well, having said all that, let's now say that you don't care about my family. You don't know my family, after all. In fact, you don't care that much about anyone else's family. You really want what's the hard-edged economic argument here for why these things should be different. Well, why is unemployment bad in hard economic terms? There are two obvious reasons. One is that we have passed a variety of laws, and the variety of laws involve paying benefits to people who are unemployed or out of work. And so when we think about people who are unemployed or out of work, what we're really talking about is higher government spending and thus higher taxes for the rest of us. An alternative reason is that when people aren't working, we have an opportunity cost them not working. We've lost the opportunity of what they could have produced if they would have been working. So society loses in two hard economic ways when people aren't employed. We lose the output that they could have produced, and the contributions, the taxes, and all of those things. And then, in addition, we end up paying higher payments to folks because they don't have income and because they now are relying on government programs of one sort or another. There are a variety of estimates of thinking about how big are these effects. Let me take a very simple way of doing it, a back-of-the-envelope way, which actually, if you look at the more complicated studies, doesn't seem off by quite that much. If we had 1% more employment or 1% lower unemployment, and we have a gross domestic product of $8 trillion or $8,000 billion, we could say, again, roughly speaking, that 1% less unemployment would add 1% to the gross domestic product. It would add, in other words, $80 billion to gross domestic product. To put that a little differently, if we can take unemployment and bring it down from about, say, 7%, where it was for a while in the early 1990s, down to more like 4%, where it is in the late 1990s, that's a reduction of 3 percentage points in unemployment. And that adds perhaps 3% to our gross domestic product, which would be about $240 billion. Well, given that they're about 270 million people in the United States, adding $240 billion, very roughly speaking, would be an extra $1,000 on the per capita GDP for every man, woman, and child in the United States. So when you think about reducing unemployment by a few percentage points, we're not just talking about something that's good for the people, we're talking about something which has a significant impact on our per capita GDP and has a significant impact on our overall standard of living. And when you add into that $1,000, more or less, all the factors of social pathology, of broken families, of crime, of suicide, which are linked in with unemployment, fighting unemployment and keeping it as low as we can is clearly a tremendously important social goal, and something that we should care about both because we have soft hearts and something we should care about with our hard-headed economic way of looking at the world. What's the U.S. unemployment rate been over time? Well, it's bounced up and down some. The highest it's been the last few decades was 12% back in 1982, when there was a deep recession that year. More recently, unemployment keeps sagging and sagging and sagging. Economists in the late 1990s have frankly been astonished that unemployment has gone as low as it has. It went under 6%, under 5%, and now is flirting with 4%. Over that time, the number of people in the labor force has been going up and up, and the unemployment rate has been going down and down. So more people are working, a higher percentage of U.S. adults are working, but at the same time, the percentage of those adults who are unemployed has dropped lower and lower. This is really a relatively astonishing performance. In the late 1990s, the U.S. unemployment rate is as low as it's been for about three decades. To have a sense of just how amazing it is, it's useful to look over at the developed economies in Europe, which in terms of per capita GDP have a standard of living which is behind that of the U.S., but in terms of the global picture, certainly comparable. In Europe, the unemployment rate went up dramatically in the mid-1970s and stayed high through the early 1980s. But in Europe, the unemployment rate never really started drifting down. And in many European countries, the unemployment rate has stayed at 8, 9, 10, 12% year after year after year after year. Now, that's a generation of people at this point, practically 15, 20 years worth of people, where young folks have had a tremendously difficult time getting jobs, where they've been just stuck outside of the labor force with nothing really they could get their teeth into. That's a lot of person power wasted. It's a lot of economic output wasted. And if you hit age 30, 35, 40, without ever having had the experience of working at a full-time job where you're really focusing your mind and your energy, there's a kind of experience there, a kind of skill, which you just haven't developed, and which you aren't going to develop until later on in your life. So when we think about unemployment, it certainly could be a heck of a lot worse. I sometimes think in the U.S. economy that people talk about unemployment as if we were still in the middle of the Great Depression, as if unemployment were still 25 or 30%. And while unemployment is a terrible thing and something worth fighting, it's also worth remembering that if the late 1990s are the good days for unemployment, if we can't be happy with the unemployment around 4%, we're never going to be happy. When we think about unemployment, one common way of thinking about it, which also helps in thinking about solutions for unemployment, is to break the unemployment that exists out there in the economy into three different categories. One category we call frictional unemployment. Frictional unemployment is simply the idea that in any market economy, there are going to be some companies doing better and some companies doing worse. Some regions of the country doing better, some regions doing worse. Some products doing better, some products doing worse. There's always going to be this process of ebb and flow in any kind of a creative market economy. In that sort of a creative market economy where things are going up and things are going down, there are going to be some people who are out of work for a time. They're out of work because of the friction of the economy, the friction of it rising up and rising down. Well, what can you do about frictional unemployment? Honest truth is that in a market economy, you can't do a heck of a lot about it. You expect the economy to have these kinds of ups and downs, and as they happen, you sort of have to just go with them and let them happen. The steps the government might take, for example, to try and reduce frictional unemployment might be, for example, to help people with job search assistance. Help them know about jobs in other parts of the metropolitan area they're in, other parts of the state, or even other jobs across the country. We could also imagine the government perhaps offering special financial assistance to people who know there's a job somewhere else and are moving to take that job. So you might help the ebb and flow adjust more quickly by helping people move into their new job more quickly. But there's always going to be some transitional unemployment. And frankly, from a big macroeconomic point of view, well, that can be hard on families, certainly, as people are moving between jobs. As long as people come up with another job in a relatively short period of time, and as long as they're not losing their job every 2 months or something like that, that's the sort of transition cost that's just going to happen in any kind of dynamic market economy. Second cause of unemployment, above the frictional unemployment, would be what economists refer to as structural unemployment. Structural unemployment is thought of as the unemployment which is built into the structures of the economy. That is, the unemployment which is built into structures of how companies are set up and the government regulations that happen on top of those companies. For example, imagine that we had a country which had very, very generous unemployment benefits, where if you lost your job, you got, say, 80 or 90 or 100% of your pay for 6 months or a year or 2 years. If you have very, very generous unemployment benefits, you're obviously reducing people's incentive to find a new job. One of the interesting patterns out there when you look at unemployment is that often when people become unemployed, a lot of them go out and find another job relatively soon, within a month or two. So if you look at the number of unemployed people who have just found a job, the first month or two is pretty high. But then it drops off for a while. And you don't see another real boost of people finding jobs until just before their unemployment benefits run out. In the U.S., when unemployment benefits run out after 6 months, what you see is that right around that six-month mark, all of a sudden people say, wow, you know, it's just about time to get a job again, and they rush out there. So that kind of idea of the structure of the benefits, how long do they last, how high are they, is clearly something which can contribute to unemployment. And in a lot of European economies, where the unemployment benefits and the welfare benefits are much richer and go on much longer than in the United States, they clearly are something of a disincentive for people to work. You can also imagine disincentives happening not on the worker side, but on the business side. Imagine there are rules, for example, that a business needs to do a bunch of things for workers. The business needs to provide daycare benefits, it needs to provide health care benefits, it needs to provide retirement benefits, it needs to look after its workers in a whole variety of ways. Moreover, the business may know that if it needs to fire some workers at some point, then it's likely to go through a lawsuit where the workers say, well, why'd you fire me and not that person? In a world where it's hard to fire people, where there are lots of lawsuits, where you have to worry about providing a whole lot of extra services to people, businesses are going to be somewhat more reluctant to hire. They might prefer to hire contract labor, where they just bring the people in and explicitly say, hey, we've only got you for a few months, and then we're going to send you off again. And again, if you look over at the economies in Europe, you'll see many more of these kinds of structural barriers which discourage employers from hiring. These structural barriers can go even further. In some cases, there are simply laws which say, well, you can't do business on a Sunday, or you can't do business during certain hours, or you can't start up certain kinds of businesses, say like driving a cab or like hauling things in the back of a truck, unless you've got a permit. And the more you have these kinds of rules, which say you have to have a license to cut hair, you have to have a license to clean someone's house, you have to have a license to teach their kids, you have to have a license to do certain kinds of classes, you can't do things during certain hours at certain times, all of those are going to make the economy less flexible. They're going to make it harder for businesses to start up. They're going to make it harder for businesses to hire low-skilled people and harder for people to get started in those kinds of jobs. Again, in the United States, we have some laws like that one can point to. But if you go over to Europe, you'll see many, many laws which really restrict the kinds of businesses that can get started. So in the United States, someone may get a job, you know, doing different things, working on lawns, working on houses. In Europe, that may be very difficult to get a job like that. So what do you do about structural unemployment? Well, presumably what you want to try and do is think about redesigning these programs in various ways, redesigning them in ways that they still provide the social support that you care about and accomplish the social goals that you care about, but even though they do those things, they aren't quite the same disincentive to work as they were before. Let me give you some kinds of examples. One example, which comes from a U.S. experiment done a few years back in Chicago, is that when you think about paying someone unemployment benefits, let's think about this. Let's think about giving them a bonus of, oh, I don't know, $1,000 when they find a new job. And we'll give them that bonus if they find a new job within 2 months, but if they don't find the new job within 2 months, then the bonus is off. Well, how might we expect that to work? How might we expect that bonus to work? What we hope for, and what actually happened in some experiments where they did this in Chicago, was that a lot of people, because there was this bonus of $1,000 waiting for them, rushed out and got jobs more quickly than they probably would have otherwise. The number of people getting jobs within a month or two went up sharply. And as a result of those people getting jobs quickly, then those people weren't holding on and just hanging on to their unemployment benefits to the remainder of the 4 months. By paying a bonus, they got off unemployment sooner. And what happened was the government actually ended up saving money as a result of offering that bonus. Now, I don't know if offering that bonus of $1,000, I don't know if 1,000 is exactly the right amount, 2 months is the right time period, but that's creative thinking. That's thinking about how do we give people an incentive not to get dependent, not to get reliant. We can think about arranging a variety of different laws so that businesses don't necessarily need to provide things in as direct a way or worry about things as direct a way. The businesses have some ability to say, hey, we just need to fire some people, and maybe they're protected from the sorts of lawsuits that could result. For a long time, Sweden was really thought of as a model economy, because year after year, Sweden had low, low, low unemployment rates and very high social welfare benefits. But in the 1980s and into the 1990s, the Swedish experiment really broke down. Structural employment got higher and higher and higher. And one of the things Swedish economists have said about that experience is that there may be a process of learning that sort of goes on in the economy as a whole. When an economy first offers generous welfare benefits, people are used to working hard. That's their pattern. That's what they expect to do. So you can offer very generous benefits, as they did in Sweden, and you don't get much structural unemployment because people don't want to take those benefits. They want to go off and work. But when those generous benefits have been in place for 10 years, 20 years, people get used to them. They begin to take them as an entitlement, as something that they ought to get no matter what. And as that begins to happen, then you're in a situation where more and more people don't take jobs. And you may have to have sort of a cycle where you then slash back on those benefits or redesign them in a lot of different ways to say you only get them for a certain amount of time. We'll give you a bonus if you get off quickly. And as a result of that, that people will get off of those benefits more quickly than they otherwise would. Structural unemployment in the United States, typical year in the 1990s, must be fairly low because the unemployment rate is fairly low, but it might be 3-4% of the unemployment that's out there. So you could sort of think in the U.S. frictional unemployment maybe being 1% and then structural unemployment being another 3% of the 4% that's out there. Final cause of unemployment. A final cause of unemployment is cyclical unemployment. And cyclical unemployment refers to the cycles of the economy as the economy goes down into recession or up out of recession. When the economy is in recession, then business isn't good. People aren't buying stuff. And if people aren't buying, then businesses aren't going to see a reason to hire. If businesses don't see a reason to hire, then we'd expect unemployment to be higher than it, to go up. On the other side of it, if the economy has been growing for a number of years, then we would say, well, the economy is doing quite well. And if the economy is doing quite well, then we would expect a cyclical unemployment to be quite low. In the case of the U.S. economy, which has been going through a long recovery or a long upspurt from 1992 going into the later part of the 1990s, we would think that cyclical unemployment must be quite low in the United States at this time, maybe close to zero. But when we next have a recession, we expect it to come back. What do you do about cyclical unemployment? What's the policy solution for fixing it? Well, presumably what we'd like to have happen is for the whole economy to start working forward again, for there to be more buying power out there. If there's more buying power out there, then businesses will be more eager to hire. How do we get more buying power out there in the economy? Well, our big tools, which we haven't really talked about yet, but we can give a little preview here, our big tools are fiscal and monetary policy. So we might, for example, have a tax cut, so there would be more buying power out in the economy. Or we might have a government spending increase, and that increase in spending would have more power out there in the economy. We might try and keep interest rates low, have cheap credit. And cheap credit would mean it was easier to borrow. Business would be more likely to borrow for investment purposes. People would be more likely to borrow to buy homes and cars and things like that. And any of those would stimulate the economy and help lift us out of this situation where we were being held down. They would help reduce the amount of cyclical unemployment and end the recession. Now, it's important to remember that those things work on cyclical unemployment, but there's no particular reason to think that they work very well on frictional unemployment or structural unemployment. As in so many of the other cases we've been talking about, what economics gives us is a structure of thinking where there are different kinds of unemployment, and each different kind has its own solution. If you're living in an economy like the economies of Europe, where a lot of your problem is structural unemployment, it's the laws which are in place about working and hiring and unemployment and benefits, you're not going to fix that problem by saying, okay, let's have really big tax cuts. You have to focus in on whatever kind of unemployment is really your problem. And when you focus in on it, that will tell you what kind of solution is most appropriate. In the U.S. economy, politically speaking, I sometimes think that more jobs is almost like a mantra of politicians. You'll hear people saying, you know, what do I care about? Jobs. What does it all come down to? Jobs. Why do we care about trade? Because of jobs. Why do we care about anything? Sometimes seems like jobs are just the issue over and over and over again. I've emphasized earlier that jobs are important. I certainly believe that low unemployment is a vital policy goal. But I do sometimes wonder to myself whether we aren't in a situation where jobs have become such a mantra that we aren't thinking seriously about what kinds of jobs. We aren't thinking seriously about wages and benefits. We aren't thinking seriously about what the trade-offs are when we just say jobs over and over and over again. To be a little more subtle about it, sometimes what we're talking about is really, are there good jobs with good wages and good benefits that offer good possibilities for advancement? And just talking about jobs, any old job, doesn't quite get at the right notion. The big global trade-off here, which is really worth thinking about in a serious way, is the issue when you look back and forth at the United States and at Europe. Europe's economies have been growing over the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s at a pace quite similar to that of the United States. For practical purposes, you wouldn't say one has really outstripped the other in the last 25 years or so. But in Europe, unemployment rates have been really high. Well, think about that for a moment. If unemployment rates are high and there aren't so many people working, what's actually happened in Europe is that the wages received by those who are working has gone up and up and up and up. Europe has effectively had an economy which is high wage, high benefit, but also high unemployment. On the U.S. side of the fence, things look a little bit different. The U.S. side of the fence, we've added jobs and jobs and jobs and jobs. The unemployment rate is quite low in the United States. We've added more jobs even though women and other folks who haven't traditionally been in the paid labor force have entered into that labor force in a strong and powerful way. So in the United States, we have many more jobs. We have a low unemployment rate. However, if you look at wage levels in the U.S. really have not increased very much at all in real dollars going back to the early 1970s. Benefits haven't increased a heck of a lot either. So in the United States, we've got sort of a flat wage, no big increases in benefit, but lots and lots of jobs kind of economy. Presumably, there's some sort of a trade-off here. The trade-off is that as you start giving people higher wages, higher benefits, lots more union membership, higher minimum wages, all those kinds of things, you reduce the number of jobs that are out there. If you focus on jobs, you say jobs are everything, jobs are our mantra, jobs are our life, then you get to a situation where perhaps wages aren't increasing as much. And you have more and more people who have to work longer hours or have to have two people in the family working in order to try and get to the standard of living that they want to get to. Which of these is better? Which of these is the way we should organize a society? There's obviously no right answer to that. A lot of the answers to that question come down to long-standing traditions about how much should the state look after people or not look after people. Do we care about jobs or do we care about the quality of job? I'm really just trying to emphasize that there's a trade-off between those two. But in terms of insights about better jobs, better wages, what matters for better jobs and better wages, presumably, is productivity. Remember that when we go back to lecture 4 and we talked about the labor market and what determines wages, what really determines wages in a competitive market is how much are firms willing to pay. And firms are willing to pay based on what people produce. Remember, in a market, firms can't systematically pay less than people produce, because if you try and pay less, your people are going to get hired away by someone else who will say, hey, I could make money hiring this person. And obviously, a firm can't systematically overpay more than people produce, because if you systematically pay your people more than they produce, you're going to lose money and go out of business. So productivity is really what determines wages. What this suggests is a sort of division of labor. And the division of labor would work like this. Think about unemployment in terms of frictional unemployment, cyclical unemployment, structural unemployment, and think about going after the unemployment rate with those sets of tools, the tools which are specifically tailored to go after frictional or cyclical or structural unemployment. But if what we're worried about is, okay, we've got a really low unemployment rate, but we don't seem to have jobs that have wages that are at the level we want, well, we need to go after the wages with our productivity agenda. We need to think about how do we get higher productivity, how do we get higher savings and investment, how do we get more technology, how do we get more human capital, how do we get more physical capital? Because as we get more skilled workers working with better equipment and better technology, we would expect wages to go up. As wages go up, we would expect firms to be able to pay more generous benefits and so on. So when we think about unemployment and wages, we can kind of think of our macroeconomic agenda as taking place on these two different levels. One level is going to be the level where we fight unemployment to get as many jobs as we can, and that's the level where we just get people involved in the labor market. We just want them out there getting jobs. The other agenda, the productivity agenda, is aimed at making those jobs as attractive as possible. Once again, when you come right down to it, productivity is the key to so many things in terms of making the economy work better.